The Community Character Hour is brought to you in part by the generous support of Lori Goetz and Clem Yonker. Thanks to Lori, Clem, and all of you for supporting community radio in North Idaho. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. And what have we got today, Hannah?
So this is kind of unusual and exciting. This is from the Northern Idaho News in June of 1935, but it's a reprint of a feature article written by Colonel Thomas Francis Meagher for Ed Harper's Magazine in 1867. Our newspapers at the museum and in Bonner County don't go back this far, so it's really fun to find something written from that time period. The article is titled Rides Through Montana and features an account of traveling through the Lake Ponderay area by a Civil War veteran on his way to a post as Secretary of State for the Territory of Montana. He traveled inland from Portland, Oregon, taking the steamboat the Mary Moody from Ponderay City, which is now Buttonhook Bay at the south end of the lake. And he took that steamboat as far as Cabinet Landing. So most of the article is him waxing poetic about the landscape based on his very florid language. I'm guessing he was paid by the word because he it's a little bit of a snooze fest at moments. Though he had nothing but complimentary things to say, except he at one point notes rather sourly that a citizen of Ponderay City, quote, was distressingly importunate in his entreaties that I should favor the people, 25 all told, with a speech on the reconstruction of the South and the fortunes of mankind generally. So then, once he makes it to Cabinet Landing, he picks up a guide for the portage around the Cabinet Gorge, whom he describes as a character, a vigorous old gentleman who had been a quartermaster somewhere or other during the war. He stood 6 feet 4 inches in his boots, wore a dense pair of whiskers of a purple tint, and was distinguished by a voice of impetuous force and volume. The war was his favorite subject of soliloquy, and were one left to infer so from his copious representations of himself. History has already done him grievous wrong in omitting to blazon and consecrate him as one of the most potential heroes of the nation. Without him, Fort Donelson would never have been taken, and Vicksburg to this day would have roared defiance to the combined armies of the Union. As he spoke of himself, in the like magnificent style did he eat, for his appetite was infallible and immense. An ogre in autobiography, he was equally an ogre in the demolition of fried bacon, fried trout, broiled grouse, roast potatoes, and all the other luxuries which, with the providence of a practiced quartermaster, he had provided for the journey, or to which he helped himself with his fish hook and gun on the road. Having come down to Ponderay Lake to inform himself of the practicability of a wagon road from the interior of Montana to that point, he was now on his way back to Virginia City to procure gratuitously from the legislature a charter for the project. Being fully satisfied that it was not only feasible, but would prove hugely remunerative, or, to use his own graceful and emphatic language, would turn out to be a big thing.
The 19th century writers are, they're so fun. I mean... Yes, paid by the word. It's that's a lot of fun. Okay, so this is older, probably the oldest article that we have read here on the show. I'm guessing.
One of, yeah. I have seen this happen a few times where the early newspapers, so like 19-teens to 1930s, kind of discover an early writing from mm-hmm. this period, and they reprint it because it's like such a good look at the good old days, you know, or like how interesting and strange it was for people living here back in the 1800s. So mm-hmm. we do see this occasionally, but not very often.
Yeah. So we had a colonel coming through just in the late 1860s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We can talk about him a little bit later. He had a wild life. But yes, he was sent here to be the Secretary of State of the Territory of Montana. And so on his way to that post was when he came through our area. And I do like how this little blurb kind of gives you the contrast of two different people who had both served in the Civil War and were both in this area at the same time, but for different reasons. So he had gotten he actually tried to quit the army at the end of the war, and they were like, no, you're like valuable to the army. So they gave him this commission and sent him to Montana. But then we have this other quartermaster fellow who had served in some capacity, or in that capacity, I guess. But he's coming out here, it sounds like, on his own mm-hmm. for this money-making venture he's dreamed up.
As always, I'm fascinated to hear just the reference to the different places. It's out here, it's the same landscape, mm-hmm. but he doesn't come to Sandpoint. He goes to Ponderay City.
Yes.
Doesn't exist anymore, basically.
Correct. Yeah.
And so, there's 25 people. That's where people were living at the time.
Yep. So, yeah. And we talked about this a little bit on our episode about the Trail to Gold, mm-hmm. that people would travel on horseback from Walla Walla up to Ponderay City, which is now Buttonhook Bay. And then they would take the steamboat, the Mary Moody, up to Cabinet Landing. And from there, they could go into the gold fields in Montana.
And then the quartermaster is on his way to Virginia City, not to Helena,
right.
to see the legislature.
Yeah. So he had a long overland trip to probably Fort Benton, where he could pick up a steamboat down the Missouri back to St. Louis and then on to Virginia City.
Mm-hmm.
But
Well, this ties into what we're talking about today.
Certainly answers the questions. What we were wondering, what happened after the Civil War? Who stayed? Why?
Mm-hmm.
Who came back?
Yeah.
This is exciting.
Our topic is about, we're talking about, the during and the aftermath of the Civil War here in North Idaho. We were obviously not anywhere near the battlefield, but that war affected every square inch of the country, and we were no exception, even though there weren't that many people here at the time.
Yeah. One kind of interesting side note in researching this, I realized why it's tricky, because I'm looking in our database of newspaper articles searching Civil War, but at that point, everything just references the war because we hadn't had the World War One.
Yeah.
And after World War One, that was called the Great War. Mm-hmm. And then World War Two. So they've kind of received these names in the context of what came after.
Yeah. Well, we have a treat today. On Thursday of last week, we recorded a conversation with local historian, member of the Bonner County Historical Society, in good standing, Mr. Ken Conger.
Yes.
And we're talking about this subject a little bit. Anything else you want to say by way of introduction, anyone, before we get into it? No?
No.
Okay. Well, it's the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack Peterson. Heather Upton and Hannah Combs are here. We are live in the studio. You're about to hear a recording that we recorded also in this studio on last Thursday. And then at the end of it, we'll be back to wrap up. So thanks for listening. Now going to that conversation with Mr. Ken Conger. Doctor, I should say. Dr. Ken Conger, right? Okay. We're in the studio now with Ken Conger, local historian and member of the Bonner County Historical Society. I'm Jack Peterson, and also here is the executive director of the Historical Society and Museum, Hannah Combs. Well, actually, this is a pre-recorded interview. We're not doing this live, so it's actually good afternoon. Ken, how are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for inviting me and allowing me to learn something to bring it into the studio and to the listening audience.
Well, thank you very much for your time. How do we begin? Hannah,
I think this is an area where the three of us, Jack, mm-hmm. Heather, and I, discovered after our last show that we are not experts at all. And so we're grateful to have you here, Ken. But we had some interesting questions come up both during the show we did about the Mullen Road and the show we did about the Mary Moody and steamboats first coming on the lake. And these things were all kind of happening in the 1860s, and the Mullen Road in particular, the dates for when that was being figured out and then constructed parallel the Civil War exactly. And so as we're talking, as we were researching this, we were thinking there are so many men, relatively so many men out here kind of in the middle of nowhere during the Civil War. Why weren't they fighting in the war? Where did they come from? And what was so important that they were stationed out here? And that kind of opened up a bigger can of worms about just the context of the Civil War period and what was happening here at the same time. And I know you have you've read a ton about military history, so we thought you'd be the perfect person to bring into this part of our exploration.
Well, I do come from families that served and fought on both sides, so I don't know which flag to put up. One thing that the Civil War, though a defining point of time, really was in a bigger context of changing industrialization. First Transcontinental Railroad had come across. The America has kind of been opening up. The Western states are starting to become territories, Oregon 1848 or 1845-ish. And so that there's a lot of people already out here settling. And the question that you bring up about, you know, what was the army doing out here? We look at, you know, if we talk about forts, the first forts were all fur trading forts set up by the British / Canadians and the U.S. interests, and then eventually U.S. Army forts. You know, the Confederacy really didn't exist until they declared war on the Union. And so that looking at the U.S. forts that were out here, looking around, there's two kind of clumps of them. There's the ones that were involved with the settlement. So Fort Boise, Fort Walla Walla, Fort Colville, those all were pre-Civil War, basically fur trading forts that then later became military forts. Mm-hmm. But the next big thing was gold. Mm-hmm. And gold, 1848, mm-hmm. the 49ers, it was in the fall of 1848, near Sacramento, up mm-hmm. the Sacramento River, that gold was found. Gold had been seen in several places, but really never ever. There's comments about fur trappers and traders that had seen it, but again, you know, they're busy with the gold of the day, which was the beaver pelts.
Yeah.
And that the Boise Basin area was 1863, so Fort mm-hmm. Boise was there. We had gold discovered in North Idaho at Orofino, 1860. Fabulous Florence and Elk City up and out of Grangeville, 1861. again, down to the Boise Basin, 1862, Silver City, south of Boise. And that's apparently what people refer to as the large state. but in Owyhee County, Silver City, 1863. So a lot of those initial forts that usually had 200 to 300 men were to protect and keep law and order in the mining communities.
Okay, yeah, we've seen lots of Western movies where people are killed for the gold that they find. So probably that, and maybe as dramatic of depictions as you get in the movies.
Well, it's I love Paint Your Wagon, and so so that the yes that the Unsinkable Molly Brown, that so that the frontier forts, the settlers came up against the occupiers already of the of the land, and so that the both the U.S. government sent troops to move, keep, and quote unquote protect the Native Americans on their reservations as they were being begun, and then eventually with the Indian Wars, the big Indian War out in the Sioux in Minnesota, Fort Assiniboine. So that's a little later. That's after the war. So that's 1870s. Fort Missoula again after the Nez Perce War that affected somewhat of North Idaho. Fort Missoula, 1877. And Fort Sherman in Coeur d'Alene, again, 1877. So right at the end of the Indian War era was the time that those forts. So that to answer your question about what the army was doing out here, mostly protecting each side from each other, giving some law, because not having a territory, you don't have a sheriff, you don't have a county, so that you need some sort of law available.
Gotcha.
I have a question about who, when we, when you say, you describe a fort, and we, I guess we can all kind of picture what it is, and you got 200 or 300 men stationed there. Those two or 300 men, who are they? Are they from this area and recruited into the army, and they're stationed close to home, or are they coming from back east somewhere?
All of the above. That that much like, well, initially they're staffed by career army. Fort Missoula, for instance, had Buffalo Soldiers. Fort Assiniboine in Montana had Buffalo Soldiers, blacks that were probably never slaves, but were able to enlist and serve in the U.S. Army in segregated units. There was another black camp or fort in Arizona, so there's several of them. The career soldier, a lot of times, were immigrants that you didn't have to really speak the language. You only needed to understand, you know, go over here and cut wood and stand here and learn to shoot. So there were a lot of immigrants.
Was it fairly uncommon that they were in a sort of conflict situation? Was, I guess, were most every day's more of the let's chop wood, let's maintain the fort, let's...
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Because because the number of conflicts, they're in the history books. And there's probably only 100 of them. In these five states, they're very well known, but they weren't at war all the time, not campaigning. Simply having the forces here kept the peace. That you are able to know that, well, if you're gonna come raid horses, there's gonna be some consequences. They frequently had cartographers and naturalists, and so a lot of the original investigation into what was here. We were talking about John Wesley Powell, that, again, after the Civil War, I mean, a geologic tour down the Colorado River. There was the Fremont Expedition, 1840s, across the 40th parallel, basically examining and looking. There was other expeditions that came out from the east. The Stevens Railroad Survey, 1850s. He eventually became the first territorial governor of Washington Territory, and then was killed in the Civil War. And they were looking for routes of the next transcontinental railroad, and it was going to be a northern route. That so that yes, that it was day to day, you know, marching and shooting and cutting wood and
being prepared for anything that might happen. So I have a question, because we're seeing, you know, these forts being established, Civil War, the gold, the different gold rushes. Was the mining done sort of exclusively by individuals who came out, or did the government, did the army, were there any groups that were mining in order to help fund the war effort or, enlarge the U.S. Treasury?
One of the interesting things that when you look at the California Gold Rush, it seems like there was a much bigger southern number of people that came out. And there's, I think there's some paper that somebody wrote that, you know, that 90% of the mining done in Idaho was done by Southerners, to the point that over in Montana, where they found gold around Bannock, near south of Butte, they initially wanted to name the town after the wife of the president of the Confederacy. Well, they eventually settled on Virginia City. There's towns like Dixie and Confederate Gulch near Helena, and so a lot of anecdotal evidence. I have never looked into the census records or things like that, but it does seem like economic opportunities were much less in the South, and so they were more eager to move and go, you know, find that. As you questioned about commercial funding of the war, I have never heard of anything like that. The big mining concerns come much later, when they start doing hard rock mining, where you need a lot of money to build and have tunneling and stuff, and then by the 1880s, the copper in Butte, that so that the large and the Silver Valley, again, hard rock mining. And when I'm talking about hard rock versus placer mining is gold that has fallen out of the rock and is just river gravel. And it's powder all the way up to, you know, thumb-sized nuggets or bigger. And it is moved by the water. So there was a vein somewhere in the mountains upstream. And then what's hard rock mining is where they're going in and actually following the vein. And so the mines down in the Silver Valley, you know, go 3,000 feet down, well below sea level, following veins to extract it. It'll be a long time before something 3,000 feet down ever erodes away. So that, no, to answer your question, that it was always just individuals, families, small cooperatives, and when they got out here, they usually, if they needed water, that wasn't readily available, they would band together and form a ditch company, and everybody would help fund the ditch company. And so different things like that.
Oh, actually, we recently found a map at the museum showing, I don't know if it was the same thing, but it's showing ditches all the way through Idaho. And we were puzzling over what would these be for, because they're usually like short little sections, but kind of all over the place. And we didn't know if it was for irrigation, but I'd be curious if it was what you're talking about.
Well, it totally depends on where they are.
Yeah, exactly.
that I grew up in southern Idaho, and there's lots of very big canals. We actually, you know, would swim in them, and at one point water skied behind pickups in the canals. And that came much later, 1910, with the Federal Reclamation Act.
Okay.
So kind of opening up of the irrigated properties of the West.
Idaho, I think most people know, Idaho was far from any Civil War battlefield. We were not in the action at all, but the actual shape of the state, this is an interesting fact that I think we discovered during one of our previous episodes, that it was 1863, there was a major territorial change that occurred. And I think at the time we were thinking, like, 1863, gosh, weren't they kind of busy out out east? What are they doing making territorial changes? But it was actually, it was a direct, you tell us, how did it come to pass that during the Civil War, the territorial boundaries of Idaho, Oregon, Montana, Washington as well, were changing during that, you know, intensely busy period?
Well, dear listeners, imagine the states of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Montana, and Nevada. And the boundary between Idaho and Washington and Oregon is pretty straight. And the boundary to the east in 1863 followed the Continental Divide and went through Glacier, down towards Helena, back over to Idaho, down to West Yellowstone, through West Yellowstone, north of the Tetons, out towards the corner of Utah and Colorado. And that was Idaho territory, and that they had initially set up the territory capital at Lewiston. And a judge, I believe his name was Edgerton, it's pretty close to that, was appointed by Abraham Lincoln to be the judge of the territory of Idaho. And I can't remember, he probably was a Virginian, no, maybe probably not, but he and his wife came out to where all of the mining was going on already, and that was at Bannock, Virginia City area of Montana, which is, again, like I said, south of Butte. And winter was setting in, and she was realizing that we have really crossed a lot of territory without any Costco's or or Wicks and Sticks. And she thought that she wanted to prefer stay there rather than going on to even farther frontier. And so when they returned to Washington, they convinced the powers that be to allow the gold fields that they were going to be having jurisdiction over from Lewiston should not be in Idaho, and having to cross the Bitterroots and going back and forth to deal with cases that are out in Montana, that's when they came up with the idea of slicing off the straight part of Idaho straight up, and keeping the Bannock and Montana gold fields into what then became Montana territory.
Mm-hmm.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, and I looked him up while you were speaking there. Sidney Edgerton, he's from Ohio. And he lobbied to create separate territories out of the Idaho Territory. And in 1864, President Lincoln appointed Edgerton the first territorial governor of Montana.
I can absolutely understand not wanting to have to cross the Continental Divide several times a year.
Yeah. There we go. I guess, yes, that does answer my question. How did that come about?
And how they traveled probably was overland to Fort Benton, because Fort mm-hmm. Benton, the steamships were coming up to Fort Benton as early as about 1840, 1848.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you know of, after the Civil War, Idaho still very sparsely populated in 1865, especially in this area where we are now, North Idaho, which is kind of what we usually talk about, quite sparsely populated. After the Civil War, I believe almost every able-bodied man in the South and most able-bodied men in the North were now veterans. Were the people who ended up coming out and populating this area, were there any significant Civil War veterans who came out and helped establish the area that we're sitting in now? Maybe
you've heard of L.D. Farman.
We have.
Of course, yeah. We're sitting on his original kind of homestead land right now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
So he was in one of the regiments of Minnesota infantry.
L.D. Farman was in the first Minnesota Volunteers.
Yeah. Speaking of volunteers, kind of taking a step back, during the Civil War, these regular army men that were staffing the forts out here, they were replaced by volunteers. So the California, one of the regiments of the California Volunteers came up to one of the forts, and so that they were backfilled, much like our National Guard and Reserves do. During the war in Iraq, the units either went to their garrison depot at Fort in Georgia or over to Germany, while the units that were in Germany went to Iraq. So that backfilling was common. The veterans, the West, except for kind of the initial Oregon settlement, my personal opinion is that it's settled by leavers, not stayers.
Mm-hmm.
That so many people packed up and left their families, never to be seen again, and came out here for a new start, for a better life, for free land. We know that in Europe, if you're not the eldest son, you don't get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So that the opportunities of being a farmer in Ohio probably was a lot the same way, that if you're not the eldest son, you're not going to get the farm.
Yeah.
So that there was the segue going into the Homestead Act. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of open land here.
And yeah.
Get into that in later program or later today. But
yeah.
But that a lot of these people did come out. It's an interesting little story about Bozeman, that the two Mason Halls were founded for the North and for the South. So a lot of towns had sympathies both directions.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of then eventually led to the, you'd see towns all having two newspapers, you know, the Des Moines Register Republican or the whatever Democrat. They would have, you know, the split that continued. But I think that a lot of the the politics just was, people were too busy trying to make a living. And that later on, a lot of people did come out. I'm living here in Sandpoint because my wife's great-grandfather, a Wisconsin veteran, left Wisconsin in 1903 and came out here. And he has a Wisconsin stone down in Coeur d'Alene, along with a lot of the Civil War veterans. We've come across very, very few Confederate stones, gravestones, that is, here. And I don't know if it's because, well, one is the Confederacy doesn't exist to buy those stones. The United States Army does.
Right.
So that I don't know who paid for those grave markers that are Confederate soldiers, but the family probably could get them, but they look just like, you know, U.S. Army issue white marble or white granite stones. So, but yeah, I think that people left their kind of hatred and things pretty much, you know, we didn't see the Jim Crow laws and things that happened in Reconstruction.
And I know you mentioned in Montana there are some towns with names like Dixie or things like that, which does speak to a certain amount of pride in Confederate identity. But I would imagine after the Confederacy lost the war, a lot of people may have been coming out here hoping not to have people realize they were a part of the Confederacy.
To have a new start, yes. I bought my dad, he was far more of a Civil War buff than I ever was, because again, Idaho never had a Civil War people, and that it was printed by the newspaper in Richmond, Virginia in 1865, entitled The Complete History of the Northern War of Aggression.
I just want to go back to, we're going to have to find out more about, I did not know that L.D. Farman was a Civil War veteran. That's very interesting. I wonder if I suppose the Farman family would know if there's any interesting stories about his, you know, his service.
And that's a good point. When I think of L.D. and L.M.A. Farman coming here and kind of being those cornerstones of what became Sandpoint, I imagine them coming here as a younger couple, but they were actually older when they came here. I think their son was an adult when they moved here. And so that makes sense. I always think LD would be too young to have served in the Civil War, but he wasn't.
If he was in the Minnesota, the first Minnesota, he would have seen he would have had quite a story to tell. I think that unit saw a lot of action and was basically destroyed at the Battle of Gettysburg, actually.
Wow.
So I think it's the highest casualty rate in any American war is that unit. So but he would like 83% or something like that, so he would have been one of the lucky ones. That's interesting. I mean, if he had served for that full length of time and made it to Gettysburg, I don't know. Yeah, he could have been wounded earlier or mustered out for one reason or another. Anyway, that's interesting. I'd like to know more.
I do have a question that jumps into the Homestead Act, but before we do that, is there anything else you'd like to talk about regarding what was happening here during the Civil War? Or can we dive into a little taste of the Homestead Act?
Well, that's fine. Is that I think trying to get a little more information about the surveying and I've got to go do some reading.
So one question I have about the Homestead Act itself that I noticed when I was doing an exhibit a couple of years ago, but I've never gotten a straight answer on it. Is if I remember correctly, there's something in the Homestead Act that under the qualifications for being able to apply, it mentions something about you must never have taken up arms against your nation, something to that effect. Would this have excluded any Confederate Army veterans from getting a homestead deed?
I vaguely remember something like this, and there was a way around it of a loyalty oath or something that I vaguely remember something about.
Okay. Because I was curious, because the Homestead Act was passed in 1863. Okay. During the Civil War. And so a part of me at the time I was thinking, was part of this to maybe if people hadn't joined the Confederate Army to dissuade them by saying, hey, if you don't join up, we'll offer you free land out west.
Was something called 40 acres and a mule.
Yeah. Hmm.
That freed slaves if they mm-hmm. fought for the North were given.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. That's coming back from eighth grade history.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Homestead Act would have been 160 acres, I believe.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. A quarter section.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think they were, I think if I remember correctly, they were promised 40 acres and a mule. And I don't think they, I'm reading here that the promise was largely unfulfilled. President Andrew Johnson overturned General Sherman's Special Field Order Number 15, which had set aside land for black families. So it very few people, I think, ever got their promised 40 acres and a mule.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, yes, you're right, that was the intention in any way at the time. And then, the first President Johnson made his mark on history. Let's see. Okay, what were we? But we were talking about the. I guess are we going to move on to the Homestead Act entirely? Are you prepared to discuss that?
Well, we might. I know
that's too big a subject. Huh?
It's probably too big a subject. Yeah. We might need to dive into that on another occasion. But I know when I was researching the Homestead Act, you mentioned this earlier. I was researching the L. Sasser brothers. And that was definitely a case where they were younger brothers of a big family down in Texas, and they weren't going to inherit any of the, I think, 2,000-acre ranch. And so they came up here looking for their own stake in the world. So we see examples of people.
And they're here, what, in the 70s?
No, I think they came up in 92.
Okay. So yeah. Again, later, the railroad's already here, so.
Yeah, but I know you mentioned L.D. Farman had come out after the war, and your own family had come out here. So we're starting to see people coming out here probably for either jobs or because of the Homestead Act, maybe a combination of both.
Well, there's really the logging,
mm-hmm.
but again, that is, that's the 1898 Ellersack brothers and then
El Sassers were more of
just orchard.
Yep. Yeah. The Farmans came to work on the railroad, to work for the railroad. So lots of different jobs people were finding here. And
but then once the railroad came, is the towns start expanding, and once you've got a town, you need a bar and you need a hotel,
right.
And so the jobs then start showing up.
Mm-hmm.
But the period between the end of the Civil War mm-hmm. and the railroad coming, 1882, I think it's a pretty empty time, and it'd be interesting to research that,
mm-hmm.
just how populated this area was.
Yeah.
That. Remember, Rathdrum was the county seat.
Mm-hmm.
That there was no road between Sandpoint and Coeur d'Alene.
And we talked about this in the last episode. The Mary Moody was on the lake. We were starting to see a few other steamboats. So people were able to kind of cross the lake by boat, but you're still having to get there on a wagon on a rickety, bumpy trail. I think, yeah, prior to the railroad, we have, I think there were maybe five houses in what's now Sandpoint. There was like one little store, and but maybe we can research that further for an upcoming episode.
We have no concept of the timber that was here. That reading the boundary survey, so when they were surveying the boundary between Washington and Idaho, 1870, they had a horrible time.
Yeah.
And first you've got to fall all of the trees in a line so you can look down that line. And the trees were so thick that you couldn't see. And that we have no concept of that kind of territory.
Mm-hmm.
This whole area has been logged probably three times.
Yeah.
And a lot of farming has come in, but this was timber country.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the Weyerhaeusers and
Humbert
were here.
Yeah. A lot to discuss. I know we're working up toward the end of the year, getting into the railroads coming in here. But we're so grateful you've been here to help us fill in some of the missing gaps and
thank you.
Share some of the context of what was happening in the Civil War and its implications in this area.
It gave me an opportunity to learn some things I didn't know and fill in some empty spaces. But now we've got some more.
Yeah, that's how it works. That's what it's all about. Well, thank you so much, Ken. Really appreciate your expertise and you joining the show.
Thanks, Ken. We'll return now to live broadcast.
Well, indeed. And here we are live again in the studio. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm here with Hannah Combs, the director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, director emeritus of the same institution. And that was Dr. Ken Conger. Once again, thanks to him for taking the time to share his research and understanding with us. Thoughts?
Well, I'm always amazed at the level of information that Dr. Conger has, and he goes very deep, and he's always discovering new things that we never really knew. And it's always fun when we're at the museum and there's a photo that he pulls out and just seeing the connections that he makes. And we're so lucky that he's our local historian sharing the military history.
Absolutely.
Well, it was a very interesting guy. As I was listening back to it when I was looking for any ums and ahs that I could take out, I recalled how much the tingle on the back of my neck when he mentioned that L.D. Farman had served in the first Minnesota. That really, like, I was caught by how, I don't know if you were listening closely, but I was sort of at a loss for a minute there. It's funny how it was that kind of connection for me, like, oh my, it happened to be something I knew a little bit about. The history hits you almost in an emotional place, not just not in your head.
Yeah, it definitely connects us. And, you know, there, like you opened up sharing, there's not a lot about the Civil War and the impacts that, you know, were had on North Idaho. And so I think for all of us, from the last episode and talking to Dr. Conger, we wanted to learn more about who those individuals were, what stronger connections can we find, and where did those personal stories come into play, which truly bring history to life. I was really curious about Colonel Meagher's character. And we discussed, we kind of tickled on it at the top of the show. From what you shared, Hannah, he seemed rather pompous, kind of a fancy fellow, but his life was actually so full of wild twists and turns.
Oh my goodness, was it? So Meagher grew up in Ireland, and by the time he was 23, he was involved in a group seeking political independence for Ireland from Britain. Of course, Britain was not happy about these rumblings of rebellion. So in 1848, Meagher and one of his friends went to France, basically to study how to mount a revolution. And while he was there, a group of French women who sympathized with their cause helped him design and create what is still today Ireland's national flag, symbolizing a union between the Catholics, represented by the green, and the Protestants, represented by the orange. Hmm. But
that's pretty incredible to think. Like, so the actual Ireland flag we're talking about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's had a couple tiny tweaks, but the basic concept of the green and orange with the white in between, it came from our Colonel Meagher.
That's a real wowza.
Yeah.
But it didn't turn out so well for him. So he and three compatriots led the Young Ireland's Rebellion, and during which time they were arrested and convicted of sedition and sentenced to death by drawing and quartering and hanging.
Ugh,
yeah. Oh, my goodness. But Meagher gave an impassionate speech, and due to mass public outcry, the authorities actually changed the sentence to an exile in Tasmania.
Yes.
I mean, who would have thought? I wish I would have had his.
So this was common practice in the 1700s and apparently later, that different criminals from the British Isles were sent to Australia or Tasmania, which was then called Van Diemen's Land. And they were just exiled. They were like, this can be a continent of criminals. Yeah. We just don't want them here. So this part is so bizarre to me. While he was on the island, Meagher received permission to roam relatively freely around the island in exchange for promising not to attempt to escape without first informing the authorities. Which that's I'm not so quite funny. Sure how that works. Maybe there were just like so few people to watch over them. They were like, you have to let us know if you plan to escape. so we can give you a like
some document
we can document that we chased you.
Yeah, our duty.
So he and his compatriots were sent to live in different settlements around the island, thinking that that would keep them from causing trouble. But of course, Meagher set up secret meetings with them all the time. By 1852, so 4 years after they were arrested and sent here, Meagher submitted his notice of intention to escape, and with his friends, they crossed the mountains from Hobart, the capital of Van Diemen's Land, to the North Shore, where they hid in the cellar of a sympathetic Catholic priest, and then local fishermen rowed them 40 miles to an outlying island where they were picked up by a passing ship on its way to America.
Wow, he had such a silver tongue.
Pause.
Oh, yeah.
Hold on. Are you kidding? Did he actually submit notice of intention to escape?
And I can't figure... I haven't done enough research to figure out like the legal process of how this worked. But yeah, apparently he had to like submit notice that he planned to escape.
I see.
I guess so that they would...
So it's like a game of tag and you have to say like the game is on.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so, I mean, I guess this is like if they're saying... Yeah, you're stuck on the island, so you can kind of, like, go wherever you want on the island. But if you are going to try to leave the island, you have to let us know, and then we can chase you down and put you in a jail cell, I guess.
Oh, that's crazy. Yeah. So once he was safely delivered to New York City, Meagher studied law. It's like, no surprise, right?
Oh, yes.
He's an amazing attorney and founded a radical pro-Irish newspaper. So when his background was discovered, he willingly court-martialed himself, stating that if a jury of New Yorkers found him guilty, he would find his way back to Tasmania. But they exhorted him.
Yeah. So they were like, we don't care what you did in Ireland. That's fine. I guess you can stay.
He probably knew that too. And as long as he was like honest, it was totally fine. So he joined the New York State Militia as a captain. And when the Civil War broke out, he was recruited and led the Irish Brigade for the Union and rose to the rank of Brigadier General. He lost many men at the battles of Antietam. Thank you. These Monday mornings in Fredericksburg. But after the war, he was sent west to the Montana Territory, where he became the acting governor. Those politicians, the backstories. On this trip, he passed through North Idaho and wrote about it. The following year, while buying supplies for the militia in Fort Benton, he fell off a steamboat into the Missouri River, and he was never seen again. He was presumed dead at age 43. And that's the story, right? But many theories have circulated about the circumstances of his death, being very suspicious. But to this day, no one knows for sure. Wow. So do you think like a life reinvention?
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. They do seem fairly certain that the kind of currents in the Missouri River, if he fell off, he would have drowned. But Timothy Egan, who wrote, we're familiar with his book about the Big Burn, about the 1910 fires. He also wrote a biography of Meagher.
No way.
And he suspects that he may have been killed by political adversaries.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find any definitive information about this.
Did you ever find out how many children he ended up having?
At least two that he acknowledged, but he never met either of them. So he had one with a woman he met in Tasmania, and the way it was written, it was like he found out she was pregnant, then he submitted his notice to escape. And so she had the baby there, and his son died at 4 months old, unfortunately. The same woman eventually, she was the daughter of a criminal. She was not a criminal herself, so she was able to eventually get back to Ireland, and she tracked him down in New York City, where they had some sort of reunion because she wound up pregnant again, and then he sent her back to Ireland, where she had his second son, but he never met him. He never went back to visit the family after that. He remarried someone else in the United States, so he technically had two
families. I was just curious about the French sympathy. Sizing women.
Yeah.
I mean, like there's more to this story.
I imagine 23-year-old Meagher was probably a dashing and persuasive young man.
So fascinating.
All right. Well, this has been the Community Character Hour. Moving to wrap up here. What's coming up at the Historical Society and Museum this coming month?
Yeah, so a couple things. If you are listening live, we are having our annual membership meeting tomorrow, September 23rd at 5 p.m. at the museum. Please do go to our website and RSVP if you'd like to attend, and we'll save a seat for you. Then coming up on October 4th, we have Free First Saturday and Hands-on History. So the museum's open from 10 to 2. Admission is free, thanks to our sponsors, Denise Simbricky and Ron Mamajek. And then we're very excited that our own Dr. Ken Conger will be doing a guest lecture at the museum on Thursday, October 16th, on a different topic. So he says in this talk, he's going to be dispelling the myths about Farragut Naval Training Station. So all the things that you thought you knew about Farragut are probably wrong, and he's going to tell us the true story behind them. That event is at 5 o'clock on October 16th and is open to Historical Society members only. So if you want to go and you're not currently a member, you can go to bonnercountyhistory.org and sign up, or you can give us a call or stop by. We're at 611 South Ella Avenue in Lakeview Park.
Well, it's time now for Bird Note. You're listening to the the Community Character Hour. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back next month. We are here on 88.5 KRFY on the 2nd and the 4th Mondays of every month. Thank you very much, Heather, Hannah, and thanks for listening.